Hello, ladies. Welcome to Women Words Wisdom, which is a podcast for women over 50 who want to challenge cultural narratives surrounding aging. Let's recognize and celebrate the raw truth behind what we wise women are learning and experiencing. My name is Robin Enright Salcedo, and I'm your host for the podcast. I believe we have a choice in how we face our aging. We can look at it with dread, or we can look at it with curiosity. If you believe that 60 is the new 40, this isn't the right podcast for you. Let's face this head on, and let's talk about the real issues. Let's find a way through it together. In 2010, I began what I thought at the time was my greatest life adventure, a move from Massachusetts to Boulder, Colorado at the age of 51. I loaded up my Subaru, bought my cockapoo, Tigger, a booster seat so he could see out the window, and I pointed my car west to begin my new life. While this was indeed a great life adventure, I've realized that the greatest adventure of my life was something I missed beginning altogether. My journey into older age and the many new doors that opened and new chapters that began. And while my drive to Colorado was meticulously mapped out, this adventure has not been. I'm a storyteller who uses the written word and photography to provide a glimpse of my subjects, so why not create a project that focuses on all the ways we end and begin again during this life phase? So I'm curious, who are you? What are you working on? Who and what inspires you? What royally pisses you off? What new chapters have you begun? I promise to be real with you. No bullshit. It's kind of scary, to be honest, but since I've always made sense of the universe through writing and allowing myself to be vulnerable, I guess I'm willing to risk it. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Women Words Wisdom Conversations, episodes that feature interviews with women I consider fascinating and inspiring and who I think are women you just need to know about. Today, I am chatting with Lisa Shewe on the topic of groundlessness, which given this time period seems particularly relevant. I've gotten to know Lisa through a series of Our Stories Today virtual coffee chats, and I'm really excited to introduce her to you. Lisa is an artist and therapist who engages in creative process as a form of meditation. Viewed as a practice, she believes art making becomes both a way to be with not knowing and a means to know the self and gain glimpses of the true nature of reality. In that space, ordinary paintbrushes become implements for liturgy. The act of drawing or painting becomes a sacred ritual, a way to offer oneself to the numinous and surrender to mystery. In addition to her work as an artist, Lisa is a board-certified registered art therapist and licensed professional counselor. She teaches the role of art in healing at Red Rocks Community College. Lisa also facilitates mindfulness-based stress reduction groups and workshops, focusing on art as a mindfulness practice in the community, and she offers resiliency and stress management workshops for the military and veterans through the American Red Cross. A selection of Lisa's work can be viewed at 108lotuses.com. So Lisa, as we prepare to speak, there are riots in many major cities, there's a pandemic raging, and the world just seems like it's on edge, like a dry tinderbox just waiting for a match. What's going on? Is this groundlessness? How would you define what is happening to human beings all over the world right now in the midst of this pandemic, or maybe all the time?
I agree with you. I think it is very much about groundlessness, but more than that, because groundlessness is the natural state of being and existence. We tend to conveniently live in denial of that or reject it in some ways. And now it's kind of thrown in our face in a way that it's a little harder than usual for us to look away and distract ourselves. So it's not that the groundlessness isn't always there, but we're busy kind of operating in our habitual patterns with our expectations that things are going to be a certain way. And we're a little off balance now because that's not what it looks like when we look out our windows, when we turn on our TVs or our radios.
So if this is something that we're This almost sounds like we're really talking a lot about uncertainty, and that's something that, are you saying in some ways that we fool ourselves almost as human beings in order to function on a daily basis into feeling this very firm foundation that underneath our feet in our day-to-day lives that in a sense really doesn't exist? I might be using terminology that's a little inaccurate, and that really what we're dealing with now is what we deal with every day. We just choose not to look at it.
I think so. I go back to the Buddhist teachings on impermanence. And according to that view, the reality of our existence is that everything around us is constantly shifting and changing, but we're not really noticing it because mm-hmm. we're busy doing the things that we do and seeing the people we see and speaking to the people we speak with. And we operate in these little comfortable as we can make it for ourselves bubbles. And it's not very realistic, and it's not very creative either. Pema Chodron, who's a Buddhist teacher that I really like, talks about impermanence as something to befriend, and that it's not the constant change and the lack of reliability that's difficult. It's our resistance to it. And if we are able to stay more present with what is going on and stay awake to what's happening around us, then we're not creating suffering by fighting against what's really happening.
So it sounds like what you are saying is that in some ways it's the actual fighting against something or denial of it than the actual awareness of this. And I'm also thinking, you know, many, many years ago, I was going through divorce and having a very difficult time in my life. And friend after friend, mostly yoga teachers, said to me, you just have to be present, be more present, you know, pay attention to what's right in front of you, because I was forecasting into the future and you know, what will happen. And I went to Tulum, Mexico, and I went to walk a, I can't even think of what it's called right now.
Labyrinth, maybe?
Labyrinth, thank you. And the people at this resort told me how to do it. And it was literally, what they told me to do was put my right foot in front and every step start off with my right foot and then turn around and come back and start each foot with my, step with my left. The point I'm bringing up when I mention this is I have never found something so difficult to do. You know, just trying to be present and aware of, as you say, things like impermanence and stop struggling against all of that. It's probably one of the best analogies I can think of personally, because I think all of us want to believe that everything will be okay. And so when we really explore impermanence, we don't know what to do. What does that mean anymore?
It's terrifying.
Yes.
So accustomed to operating within this identity of who we are, whether it's our career or who we are within our family. And that identity is part of these habitual patterns and part of that kind of denial or resistance to the groundlessness and to impermanence. And as long as we know who we are, as long as we're a wife, we understand something about how we can operate in that world. And if you're in the midst of a divorce and that piece of wife identity is dropping away and you don't know who you're going to be and what you're going to do, it's really easy to get caught up in either attachment to what was and how things were when it was nice, or how bad it might be or scary it might be in the future. And just standing on the ground that we're in now for seconds is so unfamiliar to so many people that it really strikes fear. We want consistency. And I think of myself as somebody who says no to everything and is resistant and is stubborn. And just that is my own kind of fixedness that traps me. And we don't know what to do when we don't know who we are. Mm-hmm. And we tend to just freeze or push that away. And it's a shame because that's really fertile ground. In Zen, there's this term of cultivating the empty field. Mm-hmm. And not just knowing that there's this empty void, groundless space, but that this is the space that everything arises from. And as artists, as creatives, as writers and painters and musicians, we need to be able to surrender to that a little bit. And if it means just taking the next step with your right foot first, mm-hmm. or opening your eyes and seeing what's in front of you rather than what you think is in front of you when you pick up a pencil to draw or a pen to describe it in writing, it's a place we can learn to accept being.
It's interesting that you say that, because I do, there's two things I wanted to comment on there. One is that I've made changes, enormous changes in my life a number of times since I turned 40. And what I finally learned, probably not that long ago, was that I like to think of it as leaping. You're leaping from one place to another place, like over a crevasse. And the hardest part is always the middle. It's that place where you don't know what the hell is going to happen. And at that point, sometimes even those things that you had in the past, which really weren't serving you, still feel so much safer and so much more, you're so much more attached to that because you keep... little microphone snafu, sorry about that. because you can't foresee what might be on that other mountaintop. And to me, I think of that a lot these days because it seems like this is where people are struggling. It's not even in this exact moment for many people. I mean, there's many others that are clearly struggling very, very greatly with sickness or loss of income and more, or not being able to see their loved ones in a nursing home. On the other hand, there are many of us that are not in that exact situation. We are not suffering in that way, but we still can't, I'm trying to think of what the right word is that I would like to use. We can't be where we are right now, even though nothing is happening to us in that particular moment. And when we look backwards, I don't know about you. I had a great life. There's nothing that I would like to get rid of. On the other hand, I'm not sure that that's the space. That's not the space I'm living in anymore, is I guess what I'm trying to say. I think there are other things in there that when I think of art, you know, as a writer, photographer, and I just like to play with my paints, I think that I'm so grateful that I have some way to express what I'm feeling, even if I'm not cognizant of it, even if it's not a, like I could directly link what I just did in a photograph to how I'm feeling. But of course, years later, we'll all be able to look back and say, oh, that's what was going on. But so I feel grateful for that, which I want to talk about, you know, from your perspective, how art and creativity can help us. But also, there's a lot of people out there that will be listening and saying, well, I'm not very spiritual. I'm not very creative. I just want this to be over. And I do hear that from a lot of people, you know, people that I'll even try to say, you know what, pick up a coloring book, do something. I'm trying to figure out how do you help people who are so resistant to believing, perhaps, or maybe I'm asking the wrong question, but I see it as there are opportunities to express what we're feeling, which I'm a personal believer in, is always critical. that not expressing is where things go wrong very badly, which doesn't mean I'm always good at that, because I'm not. But how do we help, or how do you help as a therapist and as an artist through expression help people be comfortable in the space that they're in, or be present, or accept impermanence, or experience groundlessness, like Pema says, as something we should embrace? I mean, it sounds lovely, and I do love it, but sometimes it makes me really angry. I get really angry, like, no, I want this to be permanent. I don't want to ever have to deal with this. And yet I also know it to be true that the more I struggle against the fact that everything is changing all the time and I'm not noticing it, that's where my sadness and discomfort comes from. So, and I know I'm not Buddha. I know I'm not Pema. So how do you address that? And how do you maybe even guide other human beings, either through your art or through your other work, and certainly through your spiritual self, that don't speak your language? Is it even possible?
I think with all of the parts of this question, the word that kept showing up for me is fear, and that this is about our relationship with fear and our wanting things to stay the same or our wanting things to be different are both fear-based. Mm-hmm. And that, I don't know, a few weeks ago, somebody referred to Winston Churchill's "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself" statement. Mm-hmm. And I had always taken that as dismissive of fear. Mm-hmm. And, yes, you know, if this is all we have to be afraid of, then we have nothing to be afraid of. But these days, with what our circumstances are like between the pandemic and the social unrest, that fear is something very valid to fear, mm-hmm, or to, mm-hmm, at least come into relationship with and look at and explore and get to know. Mm-hmm. And the denial of fear is not very courageous. Yeah. It's just blindness. But opening to our fear or our ennui, mm-hmm, or our discomfort, because again, like you said, even if our lives are not traumatically impacted, mm-hmm, by things going on around us, that we're all living in the same universe and in some level are interconnected, mm-hmm, that we do feel somebody else's pain. Mm-hmm. I mean, whether it's just seeing a picture of a sad person and it vibrating and resonating with some sadness you've known in your own life, or the fear or anxiety of somebody else, it's in the field, and our antennas are able to perceive it. Mm-hmm. And it's all around us, even if our health is okay and our family's okay and our home is stable and we have enough food, just knowing that we're surrounded by people that don't have that to rely on, it's anxiety provoking. And rather than ignoring it and say, "I'm fine," when somebody asked how you are, rather than saying, "I'm a little edgy" or "I'm insecure," mm-hmm, and being vulnerable at a time when you might be more accustomed to just glazing over something, mm-hmm, it's a step toward welcoming your own fear and anxiety.
Yes.
And not resisting it. Mm-hmm. And that is a really courageous act. And that's also where we're able to move forward in creative ways. And a lot of us read or attend workshops that for artists and writers tell us we should write every day. We should carry a camera with us. We should always have a sketchbook with us. We should make it a beautiful experience. And you talked about having a favorite pen and a kind of paper you like to write on. And those are great practices to have, where it helps us become familiar with the workings of our mind and allow us to hone our skills and develop our talents. But those are things that kind of happen in a vacuum, and that's a way that we tend to recreate the perception of safety for ourselves. And the real creative arises when that's disrupted. I mean, I have sketchbooks where I'll, you know, I'll have a couple of months where I decide I'm going to draw a snail a day, and that's my art practice. And there really is a snail a day book.
I love it.
it's ridiculous, but it's a thing where it keeps me consistent.
Yeah,
and familiar. I've had a period of time where I just drew rocks, and that was just, it's comforting, but you also, and there's a little bit of self-soothing involved, but you also get better at what you're doing. But it takes, when something goes wrong, to start thinking outside of that box. But having an instilled creative practice that's natural, and it's such a go-to that it just flows out of you when the ground starts crumbling under your feet, there's a fluidity that you've trained yourself for.
Yes, yes.
That'll support you. I had a meditation teacher that I co-taught a class with for years at Naropa, and she used to talk about encouraging people to have a daily meditation practice because it was like sewing a parachute. And that moment when we're falling out of the plane, you want to already have your parachute ready for you.
I love learning
how to structure your sentences or blend colors is a really hard thing to do when you are free falling. But if you have established this already for yourself as a habit, as a practice, it's there to help soften the fall while you're floating through the air. So when people talk about feeling like they're being thrown off a building, if we reframe that and work with our fear and choose to jump off the building into this groundlessness rather than become victims of it, we're able to work with this and live with it and be flexible and fluid and adapt to circumstances as they shift. And by staying present, we're aware of the shifts happening around us. So we're a little less likely to be thrown off balance and fall.
You know, it's fascinating that you said a couple of things that I think are really fascinating. And one of them, for years and years and years, I've always suffered from anxiety. I mean, I became cognizant of it 20 years ago, maybe, but it's always been there. And probably the last 15 years, I've always had therapists say, you know, meditation would really benefit you. Meditation would really benefit you. And I fought it. And eventually I found somebody here in Boulder, and then I listened to, you know, a few different, I think it was Susan Piver, who just made it so simple, because I kept thinking, well, I don't have this, I don't have that. And literally what I learned is however you do it is how you do it. And so my practice has been 5 minutes a day, and some people I know are, but that is something I know I can commit to. And the fascinating thing about it is it's exactly like that parachute, which I would never have known, is I started doing this in a very, very stressful time period in my life, so that now it is something. It doesn't make anything go away. I mean, for me, I find it's a wonderful way to check in with where I am and accept, I don't even know if acceptance is the right word, but talk to that space that's frightened or worried. And yet I do know many people who, like me, are extremely resistant to it. I can't sit still for 5 minutes. I love hearing more and more people talk about the benefits, especially in a time period like this, because it is very hard to suddenly decide you're going to write a book. You're going to suddenly learn how to paint. Your brain is so all in chaos, you know, even if we're not aware of it. And that's something that I at least I know I've experienced. I would assume you probably have, and perhaps some of the people that you work with have, is that even if we're not thinking of what's happening in the world, even if we don't think we're thinking of it, it's flirting around in the background all the time. And that ends up being just an incredibly, I think it's just something that I wish everybody in the world would accept, that it's okay. That is a reality. Maybe that's the part of being present that you're talking about. But I'm curious, if this is something I've heard again, when we talk about, you know, embracing that leap into groundlessness, or perhaps it's just really, I mean, maybe another way of saying it is accepting the actual reality is that is life. How do we help others, or is it even possible to get past the fear of that and actually embrace it? And, you know, just to, you know, give you something else to think about as you respond, there's a book, I think it's Being Mortal by Atwal Gawande, and it's about dying. He's a surgeon at Mass General Hospital in Boston. It's an amazing book, and I've recommended it to countless people. What he really is talking about is that we are not in our culture. We don't want to talk about it. So the end of life, especially from the medical perspective, whether it's someone who's aging or someone who's suffering from a terminal illness, it's almost like we get there and we're like, what? This happens to me too? And I found his book incredibly comforting. It raised questions that I realized my husband and I, my children and I, we all just need to talk about, you know. And it's always subject to change. But it talks about what is the meaning of our own individual lives. And for everyone, it's different. What are we each afraid of? For every one of us, it's different. But when I recommend it to people, I cannot tell you how many people say, I can't read that. That's just too depressing. So to me, this is a very similar thing. People say, I can't embrace that. That's too depressing. I can't. I'd rather live in fantasy land, or whatever you want to call it. So how do we kind of embrace those people that obviously need, you know, there are so many of us, myself included, we need comfort. And how do we receive that while also leaping off a skyscraper? Tell me more.
I think we're still speaking about fear and the rejection of fear, and that fear is a bad thing, mm-hmm. or that view that it's a bad thing. And what would life be like if we were to experience fear neutrally without an opinion about it? Mm-hmm. And that would really dismantle anxiety pretty quickly, theoretically, mm-hmm. Because anxiety is all about the what if this happens or what if this doesn't happen, and the reaction that it provoked, that those thoughts provoke within us. And what if we were just watching to see how it plays out instead, with curiosity rather than the judgment that this would be bad and that would be good? Without having that preference.
I think I love that you're saying this, because that is, as someone who has also experienced that myself, it is a moment, that is also a moment in meditation. Or if I start to feel like, for me, I call it spinning. When I get anxious, I just start spinning. I mean, it's there, I just can't calm down. And 100% there is 100% certainty that if I address it, if I'm capable of in that moment addressing it, either from sitting still and saying, okay, what's happening? What am I afraid of? And then continuing to question that. Well, I'm afraid I'm always going to have to wear a mask. Why is that frightening? You know, just that curiosity perspective. That's one way of me being able to deal it. And the other is something you said a little bit ago, which is letting myself be vulnerable and saying, Lisa, I'm really feeling frightened today. Lisa, I'm really feeling, you know, chaotic today, or whatever the language is that each of us uses. And for someone like myself who knows that that is the way around that fear that will provoke the anxiety and actually get in the way of me living my life in a joyful or at least grateful or present manner, I find as I get older and older, I actually almost can't be around people who can't do that. Because if they don't, then I don't feel like I have permission. And it's kind of a conundrum because sometimes I wonder, well, Robin, maybe if you were the first one, you know, to be really vulnerable, that other individual would as well. And sometimes that does happen, sometimes it doesn't. But I guess the point I'm trying to say is that fear, one thing I learned a long time ago is that fear, we talk about a lot, I think, in our world, which is where, unfortunately, I think so much mental illness stays quiet. We're so ashamed of fear. We're so ashamed of our sadness. You know, like we were talking earlier, nothing is happening to us at that moment. But I mean, I cry on the news and I don't even know these people. And people look at me like, well, why are you worrying about it? And then I feel ashamed. Why am I worrying about it? What's wrong with me? And I think that I don't understand why it's so hard for us to sit back and say, you know, this fear we evolved where fear was, we wouldn't be living without fear. You know, fear told us there's a monster under the bed or you know, whatever it is. And yet, I hear a lot today in the in dialogues. I don't know why you're afraid of that, or I don't. Yeah. It seems that we've started to look at people who are courageous as ones that we think are moving through life without fear. And I look at that as kind of that's to me a mental illness. You know, it's so. I don't really know what my question is, Lisa.
I think just the idea that it can look courageous for somebody to operate with fear, but the actual definition of courage is to move through it and to move right. with it rather than denying or rejecting it.
Did you see the movie, I think it's 1917?
I have not.
There's a scene where at the very end, where this soldier, it's an incredibly remarkable film on many, many levels. But at the end where he is so clearly terrified out of his mind, and yet he does what he knows he has to do. It, for me personally, watching that one scene, so anyone who's listening, you might want to, it's a hard movie to watch, but it's also a beautiful movie. That to me is what courage is peeing your pants and still moving forward for want of a better description. And
there's beauty in that kind of authenticity.
Thank you.
And when we see it, we're pulled toward it. It speaks to us. But at the same time, we can so easily shame each other unintentionally mm-hmm. and get buried in our own shame. And I really love Brené Brown speaking about shame and her personal relationship with it beyond her research. And what she discovered is when she's really feeling shame about something, what she learned to do is call someone up and tell them about it and share it. and that it really opens these doorways for deep, true communication and relating. Mm-hmm. And the "I'm fine, how are you" kind of conversations don't do that. And I just got a letter from a friend yesterday talking about her apartment building in New York during the pandemic, and that she's finding this group, she calls it the group of old souls in her building, that have found each other, and that they're relating in a very different way they have before, because so much of their interactions with each other are not spent on planning things to do. Uh-huh. And without the planning, you start, and what's in the future, you start talking about what's really going on with you now. And that the friendships have become very, very different with people that she's known and lived amongst for years.
It's interesting, too, because what you just said, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it, I mean, we as human beings need connection. And that authentic connection only can only occur when we allow ourselves to be vulnerable. And I am with you on, I think it's Daring Greatly was the first Brené Brown that I read. And I remember crying reading it publicly because I was like, oh my God, I'm not the only one. Her too. And I think the reason she's become so popular is because she has her background as a social scientist. And she anecdotally relates it to herself. So it's not just gibberish. It's like, this is the reality, folks. And all I can't imagine anybody reading that book and not finding their own relationship with shame in there.
Because of that book, I have a friend that I, whenever I do something that I'm filtering through a lens that tells me it was really stupid to do, and I feel like I want to cover it up. This is my guy. I call up and say, I got to tell you what I just did. Yeah. And it is so freeing. And that covering this is so toxic and so detrimental and creates so much more dis-ease than just putting it out there and looking at it and working with it and seeing what it is and letting it be heard and seen, and bringing that back to creative process again when we are operating in our bubble and writing the same kind of thing we always write and drawing the same kind of thing we always draw or playing the same kind of riff we always play. There's something safe and comforting about it, but it's not where things shake loose. It's not where the bark starts peeling off the tree so it can grow a little bit more.
I love that.
And it's those uncomfortable situations where things don't work quite right, when we don't feel steady, where we're not fed what our expectations are telling us is about to come, that innovation happens, and that is where we can start freeing ourselves from the traps that we've built for ourselves to create comfort.
I love, and I feel like it's interesting that as adults, we probably can't hear this enough, is that creativity doesn't come from a safe place. It just
never comes from making mistakes. It comes from things breaking. It comes from not looking at where you're going and smashing into something.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting. I don't know. I'm sure this happens to you too, because I've never met an artist that doesn't say this. Often those mistakes that I make, sometimes it might be I write something and before I have time to think about it, I post it on the Our Stories Today Facebook page. And I have a moment where I cringe. I'm like, oh, shit. That's where people respond. Sometimes I'll be, when I used to do pottery, I would make a mistake. I thought I was making a vase and then something crumbles. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh my God, I love this shape. I could never, ever have planned that. ever. So it goes back to even what your friend was saying, you know, without plans. And there's so many art forms, photographs I've taken that were not meant to happen the way they happened. And they end up being my most loved pieces of expression.
Yeah. One of my favorite photos was way too slow a shutter speed to be able to freeze action. And the whole person's movement and face turned into this big blur. And that's the one that looks like her. She's this kinetic person.
Yeah.
One of my favorite paintings just wasn't working. I was really struggling with it, and just layers and layers of paint that just kept getting muddier, and not what the picture I had in mind wasn't showing up on the paper at all. And at one point I decided that I thought the paper towel I was wiping my brushes on looked better than the painting. And I glued it onto the painting. And that was the beginning of seeing where I could start really entering relationship and being in the process with this. And it became a really cool painting. Another favorite one was a watercolor that I gave up on. I poured the whole jar of water on the painting. I took my paper towels, just threw them down on the pad, packed up my stuff and walked away. And when I unpacked it all, when I got home, I was like, oh, that's the painting.
And it resonates with, I think that's something that as artists, we don't all remember. And that is, I learned this in the painting class of all things. I just went for fun. I just like to play. I like to learn new things. And I've been doing a lot of work on when I don't know where else to go creatively, I go downstairs and I paint with my acrylics, and it was called expressive painting. And basically you layer a canvas, just all the colors you like, just layer it. And there's a whole process the teacher taught us. Then you look at it, and usually the abstract I often really like, but you look at it and you think, what else do I see there? And so I paint these creatures that don't exist. And I think there's a couple of things that are happening while I'm doing that. One is, and we've talked about this in our coffees before, is I'm not saying I'm a painter, I'm going to paint X. I have no idea what the hell I'm doing. I don't care, because I know this is not something that may even, you know, see other human beings. But the most important thing I get from the painting process is when I look at it and I create a creature, and then I usually marry it with some quote or something that just, usually it's just going through my head while I'm doing the painting. It resonates with me. It is something that I, in some ways, those are the most valuable things I've done, because I can't tell you how it began. I didn't know where I was going. I don't know if anyone else would ever look at it. I don't care if you don't like it, because I'm making it purely for me. And I think that's the reason I bring it up, is it's not just the fact that people who say I'm not creative, they don't, you know, people don't always understand that nobody wakes up one day and is an artist or a writer or a photographer. We all have all of those mistakes behind us. And in fact, we're learning, at least I learn more from my mistakes than my successes. If about nothing else, than about the kind of artist I truly am, what I like. To be more forgiving of themselves, if I could, in this moment in time, in some way or fashion, get everybody to find something like I have with the painting, which is the thing I wouldn't say I don't take it seriously. I just don't put any baggage. I don't have any weight surrounding it like I do when I write or shoot portraits. It is the most freeing thing. It's the one time I personally, well, actually, I do feel that way with writing and photography too, that I am not thinking of anything else. I am so caught up in what I'm doing in that exact moment. And it feels like awe. It feels like it does. It has all the spiritual words inside of it. The creativity. I wouldn't have said that that's what I was aiming for, But it's as close to grace. It's grace.
Grace and flow state. Just having the courage to bypass your sensors or trick them.
Yes.
Part of the therapeutic work I do counseling and also art therapy. And doing art therapy with artists is such an uphill struggle because mm-hmm. there's so much identity around what kind of art they make. And what we do in art therapy is usually very different than that, but these expectations of quality.
Yes.
If somebody comes in and doesn't make any art, doing art therapy with them so much easier because they have zero expectation. There's no status they're trying to maintain or uphold, and they'll bring a beginner's mind to it. There's this great expression in Zen of beginner's mind of not having an expectation and that openness and curiosity. And if you don't think you should be able to do something a certain way, it frees you to let whatever wants to arise happen. And then you can explore it and be curious about it and ask it questions and learn from it and mess around more. And we usually need to trick ourselves to be able to do that.
It's, I am actually probably, I think this is the perfect place to end this. I want to summarize a little bit and I'd love you to weigh in. Is, I think, you know, the trickery is really important. I've done workshops with writers, I'm not a writing teacher, but to try to get them into a flow, get them going again, get them to break through the barriers, basically, is all it is. That people who say, I don't have time, I don't have a space, I don't have this, I don't have that. And what I'll usually do with them is instead of giving them writing exercise, give them something, give them some watercolors, give them some acrylics because, and it doesn't work all the time, but for some people, it really is something that they get a little bit lost in, even if they don't like the outcome because they're not, they have that, they don't have the should, they don't have the expectation. And for me, this conversation has been amazing because I think there's so many important things that we talked about that I think are critical, not just today, but in life. One is, you know, really being curious about fear, and that fear it's a real emotion and it's not something that should cause us shame. But there's a purpose for it. And maybe that if we could be more authentic and real in our conversations about it, perhaps we would cope a little bit more with what the reality is, that impermanent reality. And I think you said something, a few other things that I really want our listeners to remember. And one is that curiosity, to that ability to sit with ourselves for a minute and be curious about what's actually going on and ask questions, whether it's our art or our emotions. And then finally, and I want you, I'm probably leaving something out, but instead of saying, I'm fine, to call up a friend and just say, I mean, all of us, I hope, have someone like that. I know I do. It's my aunt who's only a year older than me, and she's the one person I can say, you wouldn't believe what I'm feeling today. And she says, oh, yes, I do. But to move towards that, because I wouldn't, the work I'm even doing right now, every single time I let myself be vulnerable, the rewards are immense. I am terrified. I'm afraid of someone yelling at me or whatever it is people do these days, you know. But that hasn't happened yet. It's overwhelming how many people reach back out and say things like, thank you for saying what I can't say. Thank you for putting that out there, and or that become friends, you know. So those are some of my key takeaways from today. Would you like to add anything to that before we conclude?
I just love the idea of not judging fear. and not making it a reason not to try something.
That, I think, is, hear that, everybody? Don't let fear be the thing that keeps you from trying everything.
Or sadness, or, you know, it's part of our birthright to experience the full range of emotions, the full spectrum of color, mm-hmm. the full wavelength of sound. And the more we insulate ourselves and say, no, I only like things in the key of C, or I only like blue paintings, or I only like happy writing. To hang out in that uncomfortable space where you don't know, and allow the fear or confusion to arise, and just notice it. That's all we need to do, is just notice it. We don't have to fix it. We don't have to change it. We don't have to organize it into anything. Just, you know, get the taste of it on your tongue. The end. Let it tell you what to do next.
I love that. Let it tell you what to do next. And I also, the only thing I want to add to that is to remember you're not the only person that feels that way. That is a
fact.
Whatever
you're feeling.
Yeah, whatever it is, you are not weird. You're normal. Lisa, it has been a pleasure having you with me today. I can't thank you enough. I'd like everybody who's listening to immediately go to Lisa's website and see her amazing art at 108lotuses.com. You can also find some of Lisa's art on my website, Our Stories Today. I did a series on pandemic journals, and Lisa was kind enough to share some of her artwork. Thank you again. It's been a pleasure having you. And I know that everybody who's listening is going to walk away feeling invigorated and ready to roll in a different way today. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you for having me.